Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Joseph Narcisse's The Templar Chronicles. A Tear in the Sky. Narrated by Richard Rowan, with performances by David Coyne, Thomas Penny, Nick DePinto, Thomas Keegan, Bradley Smith, Alexander Strain, Michael Glenn, Johan Detweiler, Joe Brack, Yasmin Toison, Drew Kopis, Eric Messner, Dylan Lynch, Elizabeth Jernigan, Tim Carlin, Terrence Aselford, Nanette Savard, MJ Casey, Colleen Delaney, Stephen Carpenter, Richard Rowan, James Lewis, and Ken Jackson.
The priest ran toward the altar, as if hell itself followed on his heels. He didn't have much time, minutes at best. Still, that might be enough. The others would have a warning at least. It was the best he could do, given the circumstances. Racing up the steps, he crossed to the tabernacle and spun the dials on the lock with trembling fingers. He set the second one incorrectly and had to do it again, losing precious seconds in the process. Opening the tabernacle, he bent one knee, genuflected, and then removed the ciborium from inside the blessing chamber. From the other end of the church, he could hear them on the inside of the sacristy door. He locked it behind him, but he didn't expect it to hold them for long. He opened the ciborium and removed one of the communion wafers.
Christ, forgive me.
He placed the wafer on his tongue. From years past, he could hear the voice of Father Jerome, his old seminary professor.
Viaticum, from the Latin viaticum, meaning provisions for the journey. The final rite in the sacrament of extreme unction, the giving of the Eucharist ensures that the dying do not die alone, but have Christ with them in their final moments, just as he has been with them in life.
Behind him, the door to the sacristy burst from its hinges. Steeling himself for what he knew was to come, he calmly closed the tabernacle and spun the dials, locking it against intrusion. It wouldn't hold out a determined thief, but he had done his part and could rest easy on that score. He got to his feet and turned to face the front of the church. The shadows had reached the transept. He hurried to the altar and took up the Bible resting there. It wouldn't hold them off, but he felt better with it in his hands. As they reached the foot of the altar, he calmly went down to meet them. Knight Commander Cade Williams stalked down the hallway of the Bennington Containment Facility, angry at himself for being there, yet knowing that he really had no choice in the matter. Just hours before, a request had been relayed to him by the facility's warden. The request had originated from the prison's most high-profile prisoner, Simon Logan, the Necromancer, a man who would use the arcane power and the Spear of Longinus to try to destroy the Order itself. He would have succeeded, too, if it hadn't been for Cade and the Men of Echo team. Logan had apparently asked to see Cade, said it was urgent even. But it was the note that accompanied the request that had captured his attention. Just 8 simple words.
I have a message from your wife, Gabrielle.
Anything else the necromancer might have said would have been ignored outright. After turning Logan over to those who ran the facility, Cade's interest in the former head of the Council of Nine had vanished. He had other more pertinent things to worry about than the fate of a man who had tried to take on the Order and lost. But if Logan had actually received a message from Cade's long-dead wife, Gabrielle, then that was something Cade couldn't simply ignore. As a necromancer, Logan certainly had an affinity for the dead, which made the possibility that he'd spoken to Gabrielle a realistic one. Cade knew his wife's spirit was not at rest. He'd encountered her shade several times over the last few months, And it was Gabrielle herself who had convinced Cade not to slay Logan outright when he'd been at Cade's mercy following the assault on the Council's stronghold. Why she might have relayed a message through the necromancer rather than simply coming to see him herself was what he didn't understand. And that lack of understanding was what had driven him to agree to the visit. He reached the guard station at the end of the hall. There he surrendered his sidearm, watch, and the contents of his pockets. The black feather he wore on a piece of leather about his neck was glanced at curiously when he laid it down with the rest of his items, but no one made any comment. Cade waited with the senior officer for the junior one to buzz them through the gate, and then the two men moved down the end of the hall and through a series of three more barriers until they came to the room outside the necromancer's cell. Cade was a member of the Holy Order of the Poor Knights of Christ of the Temple of Solomon, or the Knights Templar, as they were once more commonly known. Long thought to have been destroyed in the 14th century, the Templars had emerged from hiding during the desperate days of World War II and had joined with the very entity that had excommunicated them en masse so many centuries before, the Catholic Church. Reborn as a secret military arm of the Vatican, the Templars were now charged with defending mankind from the supernatural in all its forms. As the commander of the Echo Team, the most prestigious of the elite strike units fielded by the Templars, Cade was known for both his ruthless efficiency and his often unorthodox methods. The two men guarding the necromancer recognized him by sight, despite the fact that he'd never been down to this part of the maximum security level before, and were already opening up the doors to the room beyond as he stepped up to the guard station. The man who had escorted him turned to face him.
Rule number one, nothing goes in that doesn't come out. Rule number two, no physical contact with the prisoner. And rule number three, if you need help, just yell and we'll come running. Got it?
Cade nodded and then stepped through the door. The room was large, about 12 feet to a side, and in its center stood a cage of iron. The cage had been home to Simon Logan ever since Cade had defeated him in battle several months ago. It was furnished with a bed, a toilet, and a small writing desk. Nothing more. Inside the cage, waiting for him, was the necromancer. Logan was a shadow of his former self. He'd lost considerable weight, his features sinking into the ruin of his face like a pumpkin past its prime, his bones poking awkwardly against the confines of his jumpsuit.
The dead torment me.
As well they should.
Logan had thought nothing of dragging the souls of the dead back across the barrier between the land of the dead and that of the living, and forcing them to reanimate their decomposed and corrupted bodies. For him to be haunted by those he treated in such a fashion was nothing but justice itself.
They torment me, especially her.
Who?
You know who.
Cade crossed the room to stand in front of Logan. For all he knew, Logan was running an elaborate con, and so Cade refused to give him anything.
No, I don't. Tell me.
She said you wouldn't believe me, so she said to give you this.
As Logan reached inside the pocket of his prison uniform, Cade automatically braced for an attack, expecting him to pull out a shiv or some other makeshift weapon he'd fashioned without the guard's knowledge. But Logan's hand emerged from the interior of his clothing with only a pewter medallion that dangled from a silver chain. Logan tossed the necklace through the bars at Cade. Wary of arcane trickery, Cade refused to catch it, stepping back and letting it fall to the floor at his feet. A glance downward told him it was a St. Christopher medallion, the kind a lot of cops carried around, Christopher being the patron saint of policemen and lost causes. This particular medal had a dent in it, right in the center where the face of the saint had once been, a dent large enough that it obliterated the saint's entire image, leaving just the caption running around the outside of the disc. Seeing it, Cade froze. He recognized that dent. Remembered like it was yesterday, the night that medallion had deflected a bullet that should have taken off his head. How that tiny piece of metal had saved his life, and consequently the life of his partner as well. They'd been pinned down in a shadowy corridor inside a Southie tenement house, and had never even seen their assailant until that shot had come blazing out of the darkness. St. Christopher had saved Cade's life, there was no question of that. And he'd worn that medallion night and day for years afterwards, in a superstitious show of faith. Cade's heart beat wildly. A hand reached out in front of him, and it took him a moment to realize it was his own. He picked up the medallion and turned it over, knowing even before he did so what he would see. The inscription read,
Every day after this is a gift. Use them well.
He'd put it there the day after the shooting, to remind himself just how fragile and transitory life actually was. He'd never taken the medallion off. Not until that horrible summer day 7 years ago. Kate's fist clenched around the medallion.
Where did you get this?
But Logan didn't even flinch. He simply stared at Cade with those eyes that had seen too much.
She said you'd suspect that I'd taken it from her grave, so she gave me a message for you.
Cade visibly started. It was as if Logan were reading his mind. He had been thinking that Logan, or at least one of his cronies, had disturbed Gabrielle's rest, and he was ready to tear the man limb from limb for doing so.
One day at a time. She told me to tell you one day at a time.
A wave of dizziness washed over him at the implications of what Logan was saying. 7 years ago, he'd put that same St. Christopher medallion in his wife's hand, just before the funeral director had closed the casket over her still and silent form. Call it superstitious, but he'd wanted her to have some extra protection in the next life. Cade stayed lost in thought for several long moments. At last, he looked up and met Logan's eager gaze.
I'm listening.
Logan seemed to gain some of his old confidence back at Cade's reaction. He stepped away from the bars.
I have some requests.
I don't have any time to play games, Logan. Get to the point.
Sunlight.
I'm sorry.
Sunlight. I want to see sunlight again before the end of my trial.
Cade didn't even have to think about it. He knew the prisoner was going to be transferred from Bennington to Longford at the end of the month, and doing so would require him to travel in an armored transport vehicle. The transport had windows. Provided it didn't rain on the day he made the trip, Cade knew he could persuade the warden to forget the blindfold and let the prisoner have one last look at the sunlight. Though why Logan would want it was beyond Cade's ability to fathom. No matter. He'd put a window in Logan's personal cell if that was what it would take to get the information he needed out of him. Orders to the contrary be damned.
Done, sunlight. Before the end of your trial, now tell me what she said.
Logan explained that Gabrielle Shade was visiting him every night, tormenting him, refusing to let him sleep.
She just keeps repeating the same refrain, over and over again, her voice like an ice pick in my mind. The lady in the tower sleeps beneath the banner of night on the island of lost dreams, but her sleep is not restful and she can find no peace.
And what the hell does that mean?
I would think it would be obvious, Commander.
So wow me with your superior knowledge.
Your wife is not dead. Simply a captive of the adversary.
Cade stood there, stunned. It was perhaps the last thing he'd ever expected to hear. And yet somehow, he suspected that the necromancer was right.
Gabrielle, alive.
That put a whole new perspective on things. Cade spent the next 3 days wrestling with his thoughts, trying to come to grips with the doubts that had arisen in the aftermath of his conversation with the necromancer. They had burrowed deep within the heart of him, their questing tendrils seeking out the soft places of his soul and anchoring there like some kind of cancerous mass, growing roots, oozing outward unchecked, until they were so large that ignoring them was no longer even an option. Not knowing would eat him alive, would consume him from the inside out. There was no other choice. He would have to see for himself. For that, he was going to need some help. Later that afternoon, he knocked on the door to Riley's quarters in the senior non-com's housing unit.
I could use your help.
Sure, anything you need.
You might want to hear me out first.
Cade had his personal vehicle there at the commandery, and so the two of them took a leisurely afternoon drive, wandering the back roads as Cade laid out the problem and exactly what he intended to do. Riley was silent as Cade talked, letting him get it all out without interruption. But when he was finished, Riley didn't hold anything back.
You know Logan's a lying son of a bitch, don't you? But he's probably telling you all this just to mess with your head.
Yeah, that was my first reaction. But what if he's not?
What do you mean, what if he's not? Of course he is. He's a freaking necromancer. Lying is all that he does.
Maybe, and maybe not. But I can't take that chance. If there is even the slightest possibility that some part of what he told me is the truth, then I need to find out. And there's only one way of doing that.
What you're proposing is nuts. It's public property and the cops are always cruising by the place. You wouldn't last 20 minutes.
Doesn't matter. I don't have any choice. I've got to try and see for myself. I'm going nuts second-guessing it all.
Riley didn't reply. They continued driving in silence for a time, each of them lost in their own thoughts. The December landscape unfolded around them, empty fields and stark barren trees that reached outward with skeletal branches, the road winding up and down around this hill and over that, headed everywhere and nowhere. Kate knew the idea was risky, and he had no desire to try explaining everything to the police should they be caught, but he was willing to take that chance. The only issue was whether his friend was willing to go along with it.
So, are you in or not?
Of course I'm in.
And at that, Cade just had to smile. It was a simple headstone, plain gray New Hampshire granite, its front polished to a glistening shine so that the words carved into its face contrasted sharply with the smooth surface. Unlike the other stones around it, this one did not contain a name. Nor was there the usual assemblage of dates. Kane had not seen the need for them. He knew who rested here, knew when she had been born, as well as the awful day that she died. He didn't need a set of dates to remind him of those times. He'd known that he'd be the only one returning here after the funeral was over, and he'd chosen to leave them off the marker. In their place, he had selected a line from Dickens that seemed particularly appropriate to him during those dark summer days immediately following Gabriel's death.
It is a far, far better rest I go to than I have ever known.
Now, looking at those words in the pale light from his flashlight, he was struck with an overwhelming sense of bitterness. What foolish arrogance had made him choose that quote over some other? Rest was certainly the last thing she had received, and he suspected that it was all his fault.
Are you sure you want to do this?
In answer, Kate picked up his shovel, drove it deep into the earth in front of the headstone, and began digging. Riley watched him for a moment, and then joined in. The recent rains had softened the earth, but all the moisture it retained made it heavier, and Kate soon found himself sweating from the effort. His only focus was getting to the casket below, so that he could quench the growing sense of urgency unfurling in his gut. They piled the dirt beside the grave, knowing they were going to need it again before they were done. Its rich, full scent filled Kate's nostrils, and he thought it strange how the aroma of life could be found here, even surrounded by so much death. The work was hard, the dirt heavy, and seemingly unwilling to reveal that which it hid from prying eyes. A backhoe would have made the effort far easier, but Kate dared not risk it. This was a public cemetery, after all, and the machine would only call attention to them. 2 hours after they started, Riley's shovel hit something hard, something that wasn't dirt. He drew the shovel out of the ground and pushed it back in again. They worked a bit more quickly after that, re-energized by the discovery, and it wasn't long before the top of the casket was revealed. Its black lacquer surface, so polished and shiny the last time Kate had laid eyes on it, now dulled from the patina of dirt that coated it. Once the lid was uncovered, it took only a short burst of effort to clear the earth away from the sides of the casket, giving them room to open it. As Riley climbed out of the hole to get the necessary tools, Cade got down on his knees and examined the lid. Even in the limited light of his flashlight, he could tell at once that it was still sealed shut, just as it had been on the day it had been lowered into the ground. As he waited, Cade's thoughts turned to what was before him. Gabrielle's death had not been an easy one. The damage the adversary had done to her face had been horrible, and the autopsy that followed, a legal requirement in the case of a homicide, the medical examiner had been unable to determine a specific cause of death. The idea that a mortician would continue the process the ME had begun, heaping further indignities on her earthly remains, had been more than Kate could bear, and he'd had her immediately buried without even the benefit of being embalmed, just wanting to get the whole process over with as quickly as possible. To be certain the funeral home carried out his wishes, he insisted on being present throughout the preparation process, and had them seal the casket in front of him. Now, 7 years later, he knew that little would remain of the woman he had once held so lovingly in his arms. The human body began decomposing shortly after death, and nature was remarkably efficient at the process of tearing it down. Cade knew that within just a few weeks, the hair, teeth, and nails become detached from the rest of the body. The body itself swells with gases, the skin splits open, and the tissues begin to liquefy. After about a year, All that's left are a bare skeleton and teeth. As Cade cleaned the last of the dirt from the lid of the coffin, Riley jumped back down into the pit, a pair of tire irons in hand.
You ready?
Nothing but dust and bones. I can handle that.
The lock on the casket wasn't a typical pin and tumbler device, but actually a simple cranking mechanism. A narrow key, similar to an Allen wrench, was inserted into the lock, and then the key was turned several times to crank down the lid and seal it tightly. Cade had no doubt that moisture from the spring rains and melting winter snow had gotten into the lock over the years, corroding the interior, sealing together the moving parts deep in the core, and so he hadn't even bothered trying to get his hands on a proper casket key. Instead, he'd brought along a battery-powered electric drill, and he used it now to drill out the lock itself, driving deep holes into the center of the mechanism, effectively rendering it useless. When he was finished, Riley handed him one of the two crowbars they had brought with them, and each man took up a position on either side of the lock, with about 3 feet between them. They inserted the flat ends of their wedges into the thin space along the rubber seal between the side of the casket and the lid. Riley stepped back a few feet, giving Cade some distance out of respect for what he had to do, and for that, Cade was grateful. Cade put down the crowbar, placed both hands on the lid, bracing himself for what was to come. Gathering his courage, he pushed the lid fully open. For a long moment, all he could do was stare.
Mary, Mother of God.
He couldn't have acknowledged Riley's whisper, even if he'd wanted to. For what lay in front of him had stunned him. His wife Gabrielle's body lay inside the casket, just as it had on the day they'd sealed it away, perfectly preserved, and without even the faintest hint of decomposition or decay. It was as if she belonged in some storybook fairy tale, Sleeping Beauty or Snow White or some such, the princess resting peacefully on the bed of white silk that lined the casket, dressed in the sky-blue summer dress that Cade had selected for her so long ago. Her hair shone as though a brush had been run through those auburn tresses only moments before, and her skin was firm and taut, just as it had been in life. Her good eye was still closed, adding to the illusion that she was just sleeping, and it was so perfect, so real, that Cade found himself reaching out with one hand, intent on checking for a pulse, half believing for just a moment that maybe she wasn't dead, that there had been some horrible mistake, and that she'd been waiting here all this time for him to come and rescue her. But reality came rushing back in with a crash, as his gaze landed on the thick piece of gauze that had been used to cover the other side of her face, the side that the adversary had sloughed the skin from, leaving the tissue and muscles beneath exposed to the light, and on the end of the autopsy incision that could just be seen near the scooped neckline of her dress. Gabrielle was dead. Cade knew that, knew it with the certainty of one who has loved and lost. And yet something clearly wasn't right here.
What sorcery is this?
Sorcery indeed. And Cade knew that Riley had it right in one. Sorcery was exactly what had happened here. Sorcery of the type that only a creature as powerful as the adversary could pull off. With a sudden flash of understanding, Cade reached up and pulled the eye patch off his right eye. He turned his bad eye just so, activating his sight. And the shimmering web of arcane energies that surrounded his wife's body sprang into view, wrapping her so deeply in their depths that she resembled a spider's prey encased in a cocoon. Cade let Riley know what he was seeing.
This is not good, boss. Not good at all.
Yeah, tell me about it.
Cade was still examining the black glistening bands of energy that shimmered with power in front of his eyes. He'd never seen anything like them. And considering all the strange and unusual things he dealt with in the years since he joined the Order, that was saying a lot.
What are you gonna do?
I'm taking her home. Yes, taking her home.
Man, I don't know. You sure that's a good idea?
Of course it's not a good idea. But what else am I gonna do? Leave her here? Just cover her up again and pretend that I don't know anything about it? Not bloody likely.
Damn it, Cade. For all you know, she's some kind of ticking time bomb, waiting until she's close enough to her target before going off with a bang. You can't bring that kind of power into the commandery without knowing more about it.
I don't intend to. I'm not talking about bringing her back to the commandery. I'm talking about taking her home. To my place. I can put her in the workshop, get someone I know to erect a series of wards around her. That way, if anything does happen, it will be confined within the bounds of a sacred circle, limiting its impact.
How do you even know it's safe to touch her?
Cade gave that one some thought. His sight hadn't manifested itself until several weeks after Gabrielle's funeral, so he hadn't known anything about the mysterious web of power before unearthing her body. But he suspected that whatever it was, it had been there since the moment the adversary had snatched her life away. Which meant that the police, the coroner, and even the funeral home staff had touched her without disturbing it. And that reinforced Cade's suspicion that he could do the same. Impulsively, he reached out toward her.
No! No!
But Riley wasn't in time to stop Cade from laying his hand upon Gabrielle's. Her skin was warm. So warm that Cade could feel its heat even through the thin cotton gloves that he habitually wore.
What is it?
When Cade turned to face him, he found Riley standing with his gun pointed at the casket, his gaze jumping back and forth between Gabrielle's body and Cade himself.
Her skin is warm.
Warm?
Cade pushed the muzzle of the gun downward.
It's okay, just surprised me is all. I wasn't expecting it.
Riley still looked uneasy, but he deferred to Cade's judgment. Cade reached in, sliding his hands beneath his wife's body, and lifted her carefully out of the casket. Her body was soft and pliant, like she had simply fallen asleep, rather than been dead and buried for 7 long years. Feelings Cade had never adequately dealt with came rushing back, threatening to overwhelm him.
Focus, man, focus.
Turning, he passed Gabrielle up to Riley, who placed her gently in the grass a few feet away as Cade climbed out of the grave. The two men picked up the shovels and got to work, filling in the grave as quickly as they could, conscious that if they were discovered now, it would be disastrous. Filling in the hole took a lot less time than digging it had, and it wasn't long before they were winding their way back between the headstones, Riley carrying the tools and leading the way, while Cade followed behind with Gabrielle's body slung over one shoulder in a fireman's carry. When they reached the stone wall that marked the burial ground's perimeter, Riley tossed the tools one at a time over the top. Then he boosted himself up onto the wall and disappeared over the other side. It was about a 10-minute walk back to where they'd left the Jeep, which meant Cade had some time alone with Gabrielle before Riley returned. He sat with her in his arms, his back against the wall, and talked to her. Told her how much he loved her, how much he missed her, how sorry he was that he hadn't searched for her before this, and of how he would do anything to release her from whatever strange sorcery held her in its grip. His tears flowed freely. A few moments later, Riley was back, a blanket and coil of rope he'd taken from the back of Cade's truck in hand. Riley tossed the blanket over the wall to Cade, who used it to wrap up Gabrielle's body. While Riley held onto one end of the rope, Cade wound the other end around the blanket-wrapped form, tied it securely off, and then climbed up astride the wall, where he guided the bundle up, as Riley hauled on the rope from the other side. Once the body reached the top, Cade lifted it over the edge and then passed it down to Riley, who was waiting below. Riley picked up the tools and then led the way through the woods, as Cade followed behind him, carrying Gabrielle. It didn't take them long, and both men breathed a sigh of relief once Gabrielle's body was secured beneath a blanket in the rear compartment. The ride itself passed without incident. Arriving at his home, Cade drove around behind the house to his workshop, a 2-story barn that he had gutted and remodeled shortly after buying the property. He turned the Jeep around in the drive and backed it up close to the entrance. His neighbors were 1/2 mile away on either side, far enough that the chances of being seen were slim in the middle of the day, never mind the dead of night. But Cade had learned to be cautious. The two men maneuvered Gabrielle's body out of the back of the Jeep and carried it inside. What had once been horse stables was now a large open room with bookshelves lining the walls and several work tables arranged in a semicircle facing toward the door. A wood-burning stove stood in the far corner, its thick black pipe running up through the floor of the second story high above. Cade caught Riley's glance at the throw rug in the center of the room between the tables, where a large mirror had been hidden only a few weeks before.
Don't worry, it's gone.
The mirror had served its purpose, allowing Cade regular travel into the beyond while he searched for his wife's shade, but it had almost killed him too. If it hadn't been for Riley's timely arrival on that night less than a month before, he would have died from hunger and thirst, the prolonged travel in and out of the beyond having depleted his body's natural resources without him being aware of it. Riley had called in the cavalry, rushing him by helicopter to the nearby Ravensgate Commandery and into the care of the best physicians the order had on call. Cade still wasn't exactly clear about who or what had miraculously cured him while in the hospital, but there was no doubt that it had been a supernatural event. He had vague memories of a hooded figure standing over his bedside, but that was all. At the time, he'd suspected Sergeant Duncan of using his own unusual powers to heal him, but when confronted about the issue later, the younger soldier swore adamantly that he had nothing to do with it. They carried Gabrielle's body over to the couch and laid her down gently.
You want me to get a few of our mystics over here?
I'd rather keep the order out of this for as long as I can.
But I thought you were going to have the place warded.
I am. I'm just not going to use the order's mystics to do it.
Okay. I suspect this is one of those things that I don't really want to know, right?
Cade lifted his hands in a what-can-I-say gesture. Over the years, Cade had cultivated various contacts outside the approved ranks of those the Order considered allies, and he used them whenever necessary, despite the fact that doing so was against the rule. Riley was aware of the practice, and even condoned it in certain situations, but he preferred to remain ignorant of the details unless it was absolutely necessary that he be brought into the loop.
That's fine with me. Just get those wards up as soon as possible.
I will. You can trust me on that.
Riley glanced once more at Gabrielle, and then moved toward the door.
Matt.
Riley turned and faced him.
Thanks. I owe you one.
You owe me so many I've lost count. But you're welcome anyway.
About an hour after Riley left, there was a knock on the workshop door. When Cade opened it, a dark-haired woman slipped inside and moved to the center of the room.
Thanks for coming so quickly, Denise.
She was a fit woman in her late 20s, dressed simply in jeans, a pullover sweatshirt, and hiking boots. Her brown hair was pulled back with a rubber band, but Cade could still see a streak of green and blue here and there. A green army surplus satchel hung from a strap over her shoulder. She waved away his thanks, her gaze moving about the room, searching. When she didn't find what she was looking for, she turned to face him.
Where is she?
Trying to keep the grin of amusement at her single-minded focus off his face, Cade inclined his head toward the stairs.
Spare bedroom, last door on the left.
Denise Clearwater was a witch. A hedge witch, actually. Able to use the power inherent in nature to bend reality to her will. Nothing drastic, just a nudge here and there, when time and circumstance demanded it. He'd met her several years before when Echo was forced to deal with a nest of minor demons that tried to lay claim to Long Island. Operating on the age-old principle that the enemy of my enemy is my friend, Cade had agreed to an alliance with Clearwater and her coven. With the two groups working in conjunction with each other, they were able to isolate and ultimately banish the infernal creatures back to their own realm. Clearwater herself had set the wards that would keep the portal from opening again for another 1,000 years, and it was her obvious mastery of that talent that had brought her to mind when he found himself in his present circumstances. Without knowing exactly what the adversary had done to Gabrielle, Cade didn't dare have her body in his home without some kind of protection around it. A set of wards seemed to be just what the situation called for. Designed to guard a specific location or object, wards were one of the mainstays of modern magic. They came in two types, minor and major. Minor wards were just what the name inferred, minor magics that could be used to protect an object or a location for the short term. These could be performed by a single individual with limited preparation, often on the fly. Major wards were another story entirely, intended to last indefinitely and requiring several days of preparation by a sorcerer with considerable power, using several acolytes to assist. They were not undertaken lightly, and the slightest mistake could have disastrous consequences. Major wards that failed outright often ended in the deaths of all involved in the casting. Not only could wards be used to keep people away from a particular location, they could also be used to keep someone or something confined. In this case, Cade hoped to use the wards to shield Gabrielle's body from outside interference while at the same time providing him some protection should the adversary have left any unexpected surprises. Cade followed Clearwater up the stairs, but remained in the doorway so he'd be out of her way. He watched as she wandered slowly around the twin bed, observing Gabrielle's body from every angle. Apparently satisfied with what she saw, she reached out and tried to lay her palm on Gabrielle's forehead. Much to Cade's surprise, she was unable to do so. She tried again, with the same result. Each time, her hand would stop a few inches above Gabrielle's flesh, and no matter how hard she tried, she couldn't get it to go any closer. She stepped back, clearly puzzled. Cade was too. Neither he nor Riley had any problem moving Gabrielle from the cemetery.
Is there a...
She held up a hand, stopping him in mid-sentence. Digging into the satchel at her side, she rooted around in its depths until she drew out a long-handled mirror. She made a few odd-looking gestures over it with her free hand, and then exhaled heavily on its surface, fogging the glass. Before it could clear, she held the mirror over Gabrielle and stared into its depths. A grimace crossed her face. Cade opened his mouth, intending to ask what she was doing, but the intense expression on her face made him change his mind. Instead, he waited patiently for her to finish. After a second, longer look in the mirror, she put it down and turned to face him.
Your wife isn't dead.
Having expected her to come to that conclusion, particularly after the necromancer's comments and his own experience with the body, Cade wasn't surprised by her announcement. He focused on the practical aspect of the situation.
How can that be?
I don't know exactly. It's as if she's stuck in that moment between life and death. Here, look.
She waited for him to join her, kneeling beside the bed, and then lifted the mirror again.
This is a scrying mirror. Normally I use it to locate an object or person that I'm looking for, like the way a dowsing rod is used to find water. But it can also be used to view an object more clearly, to look beyond the obvious. In this case, I used it to see your wife's body, hoping it might show me something about the binding that you mentioned on the phone. And it showed me. I mean, you'd best see it for yourself.
She repeated her actions with a mirror, but this time angled it so Cade could see what it had to show. A glimmering web of deep blue energy wrapped itself around Gabrielle, an inch or so from her flesh. A literal reminder to Cade of how they had been trapped in the adversary's web like two hapless flies. Yet that wasn't what had caught Clearwater's attention. Beneath the binding, Gabrielle's body was covered by a shadow of the deepest gray Cade had ever seen. Darker even than the angry summer storm clouds he'd watched roll across the plains as a child.
What is that?
Her aura. Or what's left of it, actually. Her spirit, her soul, if you will, has clearly left, but her body still lives on in some strange fashion. Seems trapped outside the natural cycle of entropy, held in that particular moment of time, which is why we've seen no sign of decomposition or decay. She might not be breathing, but I wouldn't necessarily call her dead.
So what does that mean? Is there anything that can be done about it?
I haven't got a clue. That one's way above my pay grade, so to speak.
Can you still cast the wards?
I don't see why not. Since they affect the space around her rather than her directly, I don't think it'll be a problem.
Agreeing the wards were probably the best bet for the time being, at least until Cade understood a bit more about what he was dealing with, the two of them settled down to work. Cade helped Clearwater pull the bed away from the wall and then moved the rest of the furniture off to the side of the room, giving her plenty of space in which to work. While she disappeared downstairs to get a few things from her car, Cade took a small folding table out of the closet and set it up a few feet away from the bed, giving Clearwater a platform from which to work. When she returned, she was carrying a cardboard box. She put the box on the floor and began sorting through it, occasionally taking an item and placing it on the table Cade had set up for her. It wasn't long before there was an odd assortment of items there. Cade recognized the brass thurible and the incense boat that went along with it, though he hadn't seen one outside of a Catholic mass before. The same thing could be said for the silver chalice that she set beside them. He wasn't sure if the bottle of water was a part of the ritual, or just in case she got thirsty, but he figured he'd find out soon enough. A large red candle, several long wooden matches, and a jar of what looked to be salt completed the ensemble. Clearwater took several chunks of incense cake from inside the boat and placed it in the base of the thurible. She lit the incense with one of the matches and, picking up the thurible, moved to the head of the bed.
Interrupting me once the casting has begun can be dangerous for both of us. So no matter what you see or hear, stay out of the circle and out of the way.
Cade indicated that he understood. Clearwater lifted the thurible and blew in through one of the holes on the lid, fanning the burning incense so that yellow smoke began to pour forth. Satisfied with the color and density of the smoke, she turned to the east and began gently rocking the thurible back and forth on its chain. She walked a slow circle around the bed, the incense hanging in the air as she passed, creating a ring of yellow smoke that followed in her wake and filled the room with a thick, cloying scent. When she returned to the head of the bed and the ring of incense smoke was complete, she drew the shutters on the thurible, preventing any more from coming out. She resumed her starting position, facing away from the bed, her hands lifted to either side.
O guardian of the East, ancient one of the air, I call you to attend us this night. I do summon, stir, and charge you to witness our rites and guard this circle. Send your messenger among us so that we might know that we have your blessing, and protect us with your holy might.
A light breeze caressed Kate's cheek, stirring his hair. Within seconds, the breeze strengthened to become a wind, churning the ring of smoke around the bed, spreading it out and pushing it upward until it formed a hazy yellow dome that surrounded the area Clearwater had marked out with their steps. The smoke stung Kate's eyes and tickled his nose as he strained to see through its depths. Through the haze, he could see Clearwater still standing where she had been moments before, but now her clothes stuck to her frame as if pushed there by a gale-force wind, and her long hair streamed out behind her as if held by ghostly hands. Her gaze was directed upward over her head, and Kate couldn't help but follow her line of sight. His mouth dropped open in surprise. A giant bird of dark gray smoke hovered above her, stirring the air inside the circle with every powerful thrust of its great wings. Even as he watched, it turned its head toward him, its beak opening, its empty eyes piercing him to his very soul. And in the back of his mind, he heard its shrieking cry of hunger and warning. Kate glanced away, unable to meet the naked threat in its eyes. And when he looked back, Clearwater was alone. The bird was gone, as was the dome of yellow incense smoke. Clearwater turned, and catching the expression on his face, gave him a wink before moving back to the table and preparing for the second part of the ritual. She returned the thurible to its position and picked up the candle and another match. She walked around the bed until she faced the south this time, and then placed the candle on the floor directly in front of her. Striking the match against the wooden floor, she lit the candle.
O guardian of the south, ancient one of the flames, I call you to attend us this night. I do summon, stir, and charge you to witness our rites and guard this circle. Send your messenger among us so that we might know that we have your blessing, and protect us with your holy might.
The candle flame flared up like a bonfire, flooding the room with scorching heat. For just a moment, Kate thought he saw a large dragon-like creature made entirely of flame standing before Clearwater. Then the flame returned to normal, and whatever it had been, if it had been there at all, was gone. The candle was once more just a candle, and Clearwater stood alone. Leaving the candle in place, she took up the chalice. She filled it with water from the bottle and moved to the end of the bed, facing Cade where he stood in the doorway. She raised the chalice in front of her.
O guardian of the West, ancient one of the waves, I call you to attend us this night. I do summon, stir, and charge you to witness our rites and guard this circle. Send your messenger among us so we might know that we have your blessing, and protect us with your holy might.
Nothing happened. Another minute ticked past. Then two more. Suddenly, rain poured from the ceiling, hammering them in a torrential downpour. Something large and wet loomed overhead, like a wave about to break over them. And in the next instant, the rain stopped, and Clearwater, Gabrielle, and the room around them were dry. Cade, however, was soaked to the skin, his hair plastered against the sides of his head. Apparently, even the guardians of the quarters had a sense of humor. Seeing him, Clearwater cracked a bemused smile and then went on with the ritual. Taking the jar of salt, she moved to the bed for the final time. Facing north, she uncapped the bottle and began retracing the steps she'd taken when using the incense burner, pouring out the salt onto the floor in an unbroken line as she went.
O guardian of the north, ancient one of the earth, I call you to attend us this night. I do summon, stir, and charge you to witness our rites and guard this circle. Seal this circle with your strength, and let neither man nor beast break it until the word is given.
As she said the last, Clearwater stepped to the other side of the salt line and brought the two ends together in an unbroken circle that completely encircled the bed. When the two ends touched, there was a sudden trembling in the floor beneath their feet, and the line of salt changed in a heartbeat from white to a deep forest green. A new kind of tension filled the air, as if every molecule had gained an additional charge.
Well now, that should do it.
Kate looked at Gabrielle's unmoving body atop the bed, and the line of salt that surrounded it.
That's it?
What were you expecting? A host of heavenly angels to stand guard?
Can you do that? A scream of angels would be perfect.
The last angel he'd run into had scared the hell out of him. He had no doubt that Gabriel's body would go unmolested, with them standing watch.
If you'd wanted that, you should have called Mother Church rather than a beaten-up old hedge witch.
You're not old, and I don't want the church involved. But come on, a line of green salt? What's that gonna do if the agents of the adversary come knocking?
You don't see it.
Don't see what?
But then it occurred to him that if he were looking for mystical effects, he'd probably be much better off using something other than his ordinary eyesight to do it. Turning to face the bed, he triggered his sight. A shimmering wall of emerald green energy completely encased the bed. It was so thick that Cade was unable to see through it. Neither the bed nor Gabrielle's body were visible, and he had no doubt that the ward would protect her from everything all the way up to an attack by one of the fallen. Maybe even one of those, too.
Satisfied?
Very. Now how do I bring it down if I need to?
They spent the next 10 minutes covering the proper ritualistic phrases that Cade could use to disband the warding, and then he helped her gather her things and carry them back down to her car.
Thanks, Denise. I owe you.
Don't think I won't collect on it.
They said their goodbyes, and Cade watched her drive off into the night. When he could no longer see her taillights, he wandered back inside, changed into dry clothes, camped out in the room next to the bedroom on which his wife's not-quite-dead body lay, wondering just what the hell he was going to do next. The next morning found Cade at the commandery, trapped in a series of planning meetings with the other senior force commanders. He was by nature a man of few words, one who preferred to be doing things rather than sitting around talking about them, but a highly specialized organization like the Templars didn't run itself on action alone, and so several times a week, when he wasn't out on a mission, he was required to sit through organizational briefings like this one. An officer from planning and logistics was currently at the front of the room, outlining the new method for requisitioning additional office supplies that would be put in place for the coming quarter, and Cade quickly tuned him out before the man's nasal voice could set his nerves further on edge than they already were. Instead, his thoughts turned inward, pondering recent events, trying to put the pieces of the puzzle together in a way that made some kind of sense. It didn't help that in the last few weeks his entire world had been turned on its ear. For 7 long years, he had believed that his beloved wife, Gabrielle, had escaped the pain and suffering of this world and had moved on to another, better place. He'd taken comfort in that belief, had found safety and solace in the fact that something good, something pure had emerged from that horrific July afternoon when the adversary had invaded their home and stolen her life away. Then had come that night 7 months ago when she'd first appeared to him in the darkness of an aircraft cabin high above the eastern seaboard, and his hard-won equilibrium had been shattered like so much stained glass. She'd returned to him several times since, both here and in the beyond, and he'd gradually begun to understand that she wasn't at rest at all, that she was trapped in some sort of limbo existence, neither here nor there, unable to return to the living, and incapable of moving into the gentle peace of the dead. It was a horrifying realization. To think that she had been trapped in that hellish existence alone for all those years made him want to rail at the heavens and hang his head in shame. He'd failed her earlier when he was unable to prevent the adversary from taking her away from him, and he'd apparently failed her again, leaving her to languish in that strange half-life on the other side of the veil. But last night's events had been the final blow. The discovery of Gabrielle's body, perfectly preserved after 7 years in the grave, had struck Cade like a sledgehammer. It made it unmistakably clear that Gabrielle was an important part of whatever plan the adversary had set in motion, just as Cade himself was. The question was, why? What had the two of them done to deserve being targeted in such a fashion? What made them special? Out of all the billions of people in the world, why had the adversary chosen them? Cade's musings were interrupted by a commotion at the door. He glanced up, startled back into the present, to find Riley standing with his head just inside the entrance, gesturing to him. Excusing himself, Cade joined his senior non-com outside the door.
Tell me you've come to rescue me.
We got a problem.
The package sat opposite him, just on the other side of the gate, right in the center of the drive where it couldn't be missed. Looking down at it, Kate could see the big black letters covering the white address label, the handwriting little better than a scrawl, but still legible nonetheless.
Cade Williams.
Kate glanced over at Riley.
The guard on duty is named Samuels. Claims he was at his post in the guardhouse the entire time. Swears no one could have gone down that road without him knowing about it, never mind leave a package right under his nose.
Yeah, there it is.
The parcel wasn't much bigger than a hardcover book, maybe 8x12 or so, wrapped in a plain brown paper wrapper like hundreds of other parcels a person sees over the years. But this one was addressed to him personally, and it had been delivered to a place that was, as far as the general public was concerned, nothing more than a private residence. One that was in someone else's name to boot. Something was very wrong here.
Does he think it just dropped out of the open sky?
There was no answer from Riley, who either hadn't heard him or simply chose to pretend that he hadn't. Either way, Kate figured that it was probably best. The explosives team showed up then, and so he moved back a respectful distance, Riley at his side, and the two of them watched the specialists get to work. The gates were carefully opened, giving the team access to the package, but without disturbing it in any way. A pair of dogs were then brought up, one to check for explosive residue, the other for drugs. Neither of them alerted, so the team leader ordered a pair of bomb techs to approach the package and give it a closer look. The men were dressed in standard bomb suits that were made from an inner layer of ballistic cloth and an outer layer of fire-retardant fabric, and were composed of a sleeved coat and trousers, a chest plate and groin protector, and a helmet with face shield. Protective spats were also worn over the feet. The suits made them bulky and slow, but for what they were doing, that was just fine. Bomb technicians who were in a hurry usually didn't live very long. They laid a large piece of ballistic cloth, a bomb blanket, out on the ground next to the package. Checking first for an anti-lift device and not finding one, the tech used a pair of large metal tongs to gently lift the package and place it in the center of the blanket. Moving carefully, the two men then wrapped the package with the rest of the blanket. The material was designed to help contain the blast if something went wrong. That, in turn, went inside a heavily shielded transport crate, and to Kate it seemed like everyone present breathed a sigh of relief as the door of the crate was closed. Kate knew the team would take the package inside, where they would first x-ray it from every possible angle, before running it through a barrage of additional tests, including a full chemical and biological weapon scan, and then, and only then, would they attempt to open it to see what it contained. As they watched the team move off, the crate carried carefully between them. Riley finally gave voice to what they both were thinking.
How did they know where to find you?
Cade couldn't answer, and that made him nervous. Far more so than he cared to admit. When the news came back that the explosive and forensic teams were finished with the package, Kate assembled Echo Team's command unit in the main hall's conference room to go over what they'd found. Along with Kate and Riley, the team consisted of two other sergeants, Nick Olson and Sean Duncan. Olson, a veteran who'd been with Echo for 15 years, almost as long as Riley had, was slim and short, with curling reddish-brown hair and the type of grin that had you constantly looking over your shoulder waiting for the practical joke. Duncan was the newest member of Echo, having joined several months earlier, just prior to the showdown with a necromancer in the Council of Nine. He'd been in charge of the Preceptor's protective detail before being transferred to the unit at Cade's direct request. He was younger than the other three men, and his blonde hair and good looks probably could have been an asset to him in some other line of work. He was also prone to speaking his mind regardless of the circumstances, which had brought him in conflict a few times with the way Cade ran the show. But so far he'd been a valuable asset, and Cade was pleased with his impulsive decision to add Duncan to the unit. By now the other two men had heard about the mysterious package Cade had received, and so the night commander wasted no time with preliminaries, instead moving directly into a discussion of what the investigative teams had found, which in truth wasn't that much. The package had been free of dangerous substances, no explosives, no biological or chemical agents, no mystical wards or traps. It had been plain brown paper wrapped around a simple cigar box, the kind you could buy in any office supply store. Both so common that tracking down their specific origins just wasn't worth the effort. The paper had not held any fingerprints, nor was there any trace evidence such as hair or fiber samples recovered from it. Since it had apparently been delivered by hand, there were no stamps or postmarks that could be used to try and pinpoint where it had come from either. Even the handwriting spelling out Cade's name on the front of the wrapper turned out not to be handwriting at all, but a computer-based font that only looked like handwritten script. It was as clean a dead end as Cade had ever seen in all his years in law enforcement. Which made the two items the box contained all the more interesting. The first was a handwritten note on plain white paper addressed to Cade.
Dear Captain Williams, please come quickly. Information has come to my hands that I dare not entrust to anyone else. An old foe has returned, and already I fear for my safety and the safety of those around me. Time is of the essence. I will explain further when you arrive. In Christ, Father Thomas Martin, S.J.
The second item was a standard 4x6 snapshot of a crowd gathered in front of a church. The lab had confirmed that ordinary Kodak film had been used in processing the picture, the kind available in hundreds of thousands of drug and grocery stores across the country. The shot appeared to have been taken from a moving vehicle, for many of the faces of those gathered were slightly blurred. There was writing on the back of the photo in the same script as the letter.
Perhaps this will help you see the urgency of my request.
The evidence team had cleared the items for handling, so Cade passed them around, letting each member take a good long look. None of them knew what to make of the photo. It seemed completely ordinary. There were 10, maybe 12 people walking down the street with the church just barely visible in the background. Most of the people were looking the other way, though a few had been caught in profile. However, due to the quality of the picture, none of them were identifiable. Duncan asked the obvious question.
Who's Father Martin, and why does he refer to you as Captain Williams?
Because the last time I saw him, I was a captain.
Riley took pity on Duncan and tried to bring him up to speed when he saw that Cade was too preoccupied to do so.
We met Father Martin several years ago, shortly after Cade had taken command of Echo. As Cade said, he was just a lowly captain back then. Martin and several other priests in the Boston Archdiocese nearby were having trouble with a new cult that had sprung up among the street gangs in the area. They contacted the order, and since the cult had shown no hesitation to use violence against the church, a combat squad was sent in to deal with it.
Sounds fairly routine.
Yeah, you'd think so. Unfortunately, we were way off base.
What happened?
The squad disappeared without a trace 3 weeks after arriving in the area. 8 highly trained men, every single one of them a veteran combat soldier, trained specifically for situations like this. So, of course, Echo gets the call. Our orders were to find out what happened to the squad and to deal with the cult that had gotten the order involved in the first place.
Recognizing that the order's initial show of force had done little good, Kay decided to take a different approach. He sent one of our men, a lieutenant, into the neighborhood undercover with orders to set up a safe house, and then to make contact with the local clergy. For the first few days, everything went without a hitch. Bishop, Jonathan Bishop, that was the lieutenant's name, got us a secure location, rendezvoused with the locals, and let us know it was okay to bring the rest of the team. By the time we had arrived, Bishop had vanished, just like the men from the first squad.
Olsen stared off into space as he continued, and from the look on his face, Duncan knew he was reliving it in his mind's eye.
We got a lead that both Bishop and the leaders of the cult could be found in an abandoned warehouse over in Roxbury. Timing was critical. First squad was guiding the Bishop's residence in Cambridge, and the second squad was en route. We knew we couldn't wait, so Cade made the decision to hit the warehouse with only the command squad, hoping things wouldn't get too hairy before the reinforcements arrived.
Good Lord, just the three of you?
Just the three of us. Me, Cade, and Riley. What can I say? We were younger then. Younger and full of confidence. You know how it is. Sometimes you just think you're invincible.
We snuck in through the skylight, and from the second floor walkway, we could see Bishop tied to a post in the middle of the warehouse. He wasn't moving. And with the place looking empty, we thought maybe we were too late, that they'd already executed him and left his body for us to find.
So what did you do?
We made our way down to the first floor and over to where they'd left Bishop. Olsen and me, we stood watch while Kate checked him out. Turned out, we were right. Bishop was cold as ice. That was our first mistake.
And it was a big one. Bishop might have been dead, but that didn't mean he was out of the fight. We found that out the hard way when he reared up and tried to rip Cade's throat out. Of course, by then, Riley and I had our hands full as a horde of Shang-Chi began pouring out of nowhere, charging right for us.
Shang what?
Shi. Shang-Chi. Also known as the Shadow People. As far as anyone knows, they originated in China. But they've spread over the last few centuries and now can be found throughout Central and Southeast Asia. Tradition says they're formed when an individual has an outstanding karmic debt that must be paid. A debt so enormous that it prevents the soul from moving onward through the great cycle and forces the body to rise again from death, More often than not, the higher, rational aspect of the soul, the Hun, becomes dormant, leaving the Po, or the lower, bestial aspect of the soul, in control of the resurrected creature.
Sounds pleasant.
Neither truly living nor altogether dead, the Shang-Chi are creatures without the essence of life, or Qi, as the Chinese call it, and therefore must constantly steal it from the living to sustain their existence. They also have the option of turning their victims into a lesser version of themselves, bloodthirsty, undead creatures that crave the flesh rather than the life force of the living.
Which is just what we were facing.
Right. And good thing, too, as full-blood Shang-Chi aren't as susceptible to firearms as are their lesser counterparts. Cade dealt with Bishop while Riley and I held off several attacks by the others. By the time we'd beaten back the third wave, we'd run out of ammunition and had to resort to using our blades.
But if you were so badly outnumbered, how did you manage to survive?
We almost didn't. We got lucky, that's all. Second squad showed up at the last moment, cutting into the Shang-Chi from behind, making them believe we'd set up a trap for them. Believing they were vastly outnumbered, they retreated, leaving us to clean up the mess. Which wasn't that hard, since the bodies turned into ash the minute their queen disappeared out the back door.
And Bishop? Did you ever find out what happened to him?
Yeah. Yeah, we did.
But Olsen didn't say anything more, and before Duncan could ask him to explain further, Kate tossed the photo onto the tabletop in front of them, a frown of disgust plain on his face.
I don't get it. What does he expect us to see in this thing?
Why don't we just call him and ask?
With the others looking on, Cade summoned an initiate and gave instructions for him to bring them any and all telephone numbers for either Father Thomas Martin or the Church of the Blessed Sorrow, both in Brookline, Massachusetts. It didn't take the initiate long to come back with the information. Most of it was readily available through directory assistance, and the single number that wasn't, the priest's personal cell phone, was in one of the order's data banks. Cade spent the next several minutes trying each number, all without success. In light of the nature of Martin's message, the lack of response made Cade more than a little uneasy, and so he made a snap decision based more on instinct than reason.
I think it's time we take a little road trip. Grab the kit bag and meet me in the motor pool in 20.
Just like that, Echo's command unit was headed for Boston.